Do you know what the most requested item at homeless shelters all across the country is? It's socks. I didn't know that, and when I found that out, it made me sad. But it also made a lot of sense. At homeless shelters, new clothing is in extremely high demand. This fact is the driving force behind my friends at Bombas. Bombas exists to help support the homeless community and to bring awareness to an underpublicized problem in the United States. Bombas was founded on the philosophy of donating socks to those in need. But it's evolved to go deeper into the community. The more clothing items they sell, the more they donate. As they grow, their giving and community efforts will continue to grow right alongside them. Over 40 million acts of kindness. One purchase equals one donation. How many of us just go to a big box retail store and buy name brand socks without even second guessing it? Imagine if your purchase could support people in this country who need something as basic to us as a pair of warm, comfortable socks. Folks, do me a favor and go to bombas.com. That's BOMBAS.com. Head over and insert the code COMFORT at checkout to get 20% off your first pair of socks. Bombas covers all sizes, features great designs, including their upcoming holiday collection, and you'll be making a purchase that serves a basic human right and truly helps one of the greatest efforts in our country. That's bombas.com. BOMBAS.com. Okay, and we're back. Brendan from Master Talk. How you doing, sir?
Very good, man. How about yourself?
I am doing well. I remember having a teacher in grade school that said, never say you're doing good, always say you're doing well, because that gives people the idea that you're well mentally, physically, emotionally, and everything. So I that always stood with me, when even when I was like in sixth grade. I remember that. Pretty interesting.
Interesting.
You know, I always start the show by giving some context as to how I know my guest. I actually came across your YouTube channel because it popped up as a recommended video while I was watching a TED Talk several months ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I've always been fascinated by people that can command an audience. I mean, I think it's one of those abilities that can certainly be learned. Of course, we'll talk about that. But there are also people that have this natural ability to sort of grab folks using, you know, many tools that a good public speaker can call on. But before we get into the conversation tonight, tell everyone a little about your education, your professional background. We'll start with that.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't expect that one, but sure. So I went to Concordia University. I studied accounting. So I have a bachelor's. And then after that, what happened for me, how it kind of linked to communication and what I do today, was back in business school. What I used to do is I used to do these things called case competitions. So Think of it like professional sports, but for nerds. So other guys my age were like playing football, soccer, basketball, things I never really understood. I'd use the same competitive spirit that all those guys did. And I did presentations instead. So I practiced like crazy, presented over 500 times in my uni days, coached dozens of people. Then I got a great job in corporate America, or I guess corporate Canada. In my case, I'm based in Montreal. Then I kind of just said, what do I do with my life now? And I realized I was one of the youngest speech coaches in the world. So I started making videos for people who couldn't afford me. And here we are today.
Wow. That's awesome. Now I feel like right now, maybe perhaps more than ever, with the vast majority of the world working, educating, and living from home now, essentially, being able to command an audience through video conferencing platforms, that might be perhaps more important than ever. What are your thoughts on how the pandemic has changed sort of the way we communicate just in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that we need to think about this is that the difference between the online and the offline world is that when you're in person, you can gauge the reaction of your audience, but you don't have that luxury in online. So let's say I'm giving a workshop to you and your friends or your group of people around you, and I say a joke. So two things will happen. Number one, you're either going to laugh at the joke and say, oh man, this Brendan guy is pretty funny. Or number two, which is more likely, you're going to look at me and say, this guy's not funny. He really should not be saying any jokes.
Yeah.
But regardless, what happens is I get the audience's reaction. I see how you're reacting to me. And I can say, okay, maybe I'm not so funny. Maybe I should change up my tactics. I don't have that luxury in the setting of an online presentation. Even in this conversation, I have no clue how you're reacting to me because I
Right.
can't see you. But
Right.
this is also true if you're on a Zoom call with 20 to 25 people, even if everyone has their video on, you got those little screens. So what's the punchline? The punchline is the same joke that you said with the same energy, the same positivity, and the same rigor that you would have in person. You need to say with the same level of energy and assume it's funny. And that is
Yeah.
challenging. So the key to fixing this or to making it better, there's two things that you could do immediately. One is what I call the virtual presentation room. So what you do is you just bring a bunch of people who are really critical of you in general and just criticize every part of you, from the stuff that you're wearing, from the lighting that you have, from the way that you're speaking to the way that you're presenting. They poke as many holes as they can,
Yeah.
ask you as many questions, drill every part of your presentation. They don't need to be coaches, just friends of yours that aren't that slept on the wrong side of the bed that morning. And then after, what you'll be exceptional. The other thing that you can do is what I call imagining the perfect audience. So when I started podcasting or even my YouTube videos, it was really bizarre because people would ask me questions about my life, and I'm just like, "Hey, this stranger is asking me a question. Why is Chris doing this? So weird." But then over time, what happens is you start to develop a positive impression and an interaction with the people you're speaking to. So it
Yeah.
quickly transitions from "Who's this Chris guy?" to "Hey, Chris really cares about helping and adding value to his audience. He's creating this podcast, this experience to make sure that the people around him are benefiting and learning and growing. So I'm going to assume that I've known Chris for years, and that's how I'm going to converse with him." That takes time to get right, but over time, as you present and you get more positive feedback, that belief will eventually become true for you.
Yeah, wow. And piggybacking off of that and talking about video conferencing and everything, I mean, how do you think social media helps or maybe even hinders, that type of communication? I mean, is it a benefit? Is there a drawback there at all?
Right. So the way that I think about this to kind of play a balanced role here is social media is a tool like anything else. Whether it's a phone, whether it's a screwdriver, if I am even more simpler here, in the sense it depends what you do with it. So sure, is our phones more distracting? Is social media a lot more distracting and hinders our message? If you see it that way, it will. But at the same time, if you leverage it in the right way, you can meet a bunch of amazing people, like in this conversation that we're having now, which wouldn't have been possible if we didn't have email addresses, because you never would have been able to reach me. So
Yeah.
that's also a thing. So I think it's more about, in my opinion, social media is a lot like money in the sense that it's an amplifier of who you already are. So if you're someone who's a really kind person, you make more money, you'll end up donating more money. But if you're a bad person, you'll probably spend that on things that you shouldn't be. Same thing with social media. If you're generally just a good person, you want to help people, it's a great platform that allows you to reach thousands of people. Like when you said I was recommended, I was like, wow, that's amazing. I never
Yeah.
that never would have happened if I wasn't on social media, if I was
Right.
just speaking in my local city. But the opposite is also true. If my goal is just to be viral and not make anything interesting or important, I'm getting popular for the wrong reasons, for the reasons that aren't actually influencing the culture, as Seth Godin puts it. So yeah,
Yeah.
it's an amplifier of who you are.
As you're talking about that, I want to ask you something that you've probably been asked 100 times before, but I think it bears repeating.
For
Just for
sure.
the people who maybe haven't heard of you before, or maybe just don't get sort of this concept and kind of want to learn on it. Why is it so vital to us that we learn to master our talk and the way we communicate? I mean, regardless of the platform, just in general.
Yeah, I love that you used my lingo there. I appreciate it. It's
Yeah,
great.
sure,
So
man.
the way that I think about this is we need to all realize that public speaking has very little to do with presentation, but rather everything that you do and everything that you are. It's the tough questions that you have with your spouse or your husband or your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your kids or your family members. It's the dinners that you have with the people that are really interesting to you, especially when you're yelling at them over controversial subjects like this election, for instance, or things like business negotiations. Everything that you do is communication. So mastering your talk doesn't mean being on a stage in front of 1,000 people. It means going to a foreign country that you don't know the language, and for some reason, you don't understand. That person just gets you. That person just understands you, even if you have no clue what they're saying. That is what public speaking is, and that is the reason why you want to master it. And for those of you who are much more ambitious than that and say, "I have an idea worth sharing, I have a podcast like Chris, and I want to scale," public speaking is the difference between reaching 10 people versus 10 million people.
Yeah, good point. And I think the one question I really wanted to kind of ask you about is, as I'm kind of formulating questions to talk about tonight in our conversation, it's probably well known that obviously we could all use a lesson or two when it comes to the way we come across, you know, the way we make people feel when we're talking with them. Do you think, is there a fundamental problem with conversation competence? Do you think if we all took the time to both consider what we're saying and then consider how we're saying it, that we'd have much stronger and more rewarding relationships?
1,000%. I love the way you phrase that, conversation competence. I might have to steal that one for you from
Yeah.
you. But I think the way that I see it is most people aren't spending enough attention on how they're saying it rather than what they're saying. So for example, if I come up to you, Chris, and I go, "Yeah, Chris, you know, it's great to be here. Yeah, by the way, I got like 10 minutes here. I don't really want to be here." And then you're just like, "Oh, wow, this guy's like really aggressive. Like, what's he trying to do here?" But rather, if I say something like, same thing, "Hey, Chris, you know, it's really great to be here. Hey, by the way, I only have 10 minutes to speak to. I hope that's okay." You're gonna look at me and say, "Wow, this guy's so authentic. He only has 10 minutes to talk to me." Obviously, I don't have just 10 minutes, but you get it. Just the way that
Yeah.
I'm speaking, even if I'm saying the same thing, the way that I'm coming off is completely different. So, how do we bring this back into our conversations? Because I'm sure you're looking at me like, okay, Brenda's the expert, whatever. So, the way that we think about this is what we call mirroring. So mirroring is when you mirror the energy of the other person. So I'll give you an example with this very show. Let's say I'm on a show with an extroverted host, and he comes up to me and he goes, "Yo, Brendan, it's so exciting. I've been watching all your videos. I'm so great to be here. Thanks for being here." So the way that I reply is I go, "Well, Nick, it's so great to be here too. I'm super excited to be here."
Yeah.
But the opposite is also true. Paula comes onto a podcast and I go, "Hey, Paula, are you new to this podcasting?" And she goes, "Yeah, you know, Brenda, I was looking forward to interviewing you. I'm a bit shy, I'm a bit nervous." And I go, "Hey, no worries, Paul. Why don't you start with a couple of questions? Let's get the ball rolling." Notice what I'm doing here, Chris. I'm mirroring the energy to the person I'm speaking to make them feel comfortable in that moment in time that we're together, right?
Yeah.
So that's something very difficult to do, and somebody needs to give you hard feedback to figure that out. And that doesn't need to be a coach. People around you that go, like for me, when I was in university, my friends would rail me all the time. They're like, "Brendan, you're way too aggressive when you speak to people. You're always talking, talking, talking. You're always like, you need to do this, you need to do this." And nobody feels your energy. But rather, if you program the way that you speak so that it sounds like honey, that sounds in such a beautiful way that people just want to follow and listen to every single word that you say, then you'll be able to influence a lot more people. So you need that hard feedback from the people that you know, like, and trust. But it's definitely possible to increase our, as you say, our conversation competence, so to speak.
Yeah, and you know, you've touched on the idea of having people sort of give you hard feedback and give you sort of that tough love, you know, when you're trying to work out maybe potential presentation or something of that nature. Can you expand a little bit about that? Because I think that's really important. That's an important point to drive home. I mean, how important is that to get honest, raw feedback and say, hey, this part really sucks. You got to make this better, or this you're just not coming across. I'm not feeling it. I mean, how important is that to fine-tuning a presentation when it's, you know, when you're practicing and you're trying to get the real deal down?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my coach tells me this all the time, and I totally agree. The bigger the dream, the better the team. You know,
Yeah.
if you have a bigger dream for what you want to do, you need a better team that is railing you. And that doesn't mean hiring employees. That means having really smart people around you that aren't afraid to run you through a wall, essentially. And if I'm being perfectly honest, I think the reason, and really the only reason, that I've accumulated so much knowledge in public speaking, communication at such a young age, because remember, for the audience that's listening, I started Mass Talk when I was only 22, right? And I started coaching C levels, which is CEOs and stuff, at 23. So the reason I got that good really young is because there's people around me who still, obviously today, run me through walls. So I think feedback is what gets you to the next level. And here's an easy way that you can implement it in a way that it exponentially increases your public speaking skills. What you do is you make a video of you speaking, and then when you send it to 10, 15 of the smartest people you know, but you don't ask them for feedback. You ask them for time-stamped feedback. What does that mean? So let's
Yeah.
say you give a 5-minute presentation. Isabella would look at you and go, "Hey, Brennan, go to 3-minute 54." And then I skip to the video, 3-minute 54. And she goes, "Why are you smiling if you're talking about a car accident?" And I go, "Whoops." And then, but the other 15 people are doing the same thing. So I'm going through all the timestamps second by second, and I'm looking at all the 73 mistakes that I made. So when I do version two of that same presentation, it's on a whole other level. And I still do that today, even if I'm a professional now.
Yeah, and I think that can be painful. That could be a painful process. But I remember doing that with my wife and other people. I would write something, for the Earhart piece I was doing. We do a lot of historical content, and we'd write this piece, we'd put it out, and I would spend 3 or 4 hours on it, and they would just tear it to shreds. And then for a while, I remember I would just get really. I'd get really defensive, and that's my fault because that's just it was it's a baby. It's like, you made this baby and you want to take care of it and you want to protect it, and people are tearing it to shreds. So I think now it's more of along the lines of, okay, let's, do your thing, and then, I'll kind of go back and fine tune and fine tune and fine tune. I think you kind of develop a thick skin, I think, at that point.
Absolutely. I think the way that I see it, kind of how to get you to me, so to speak, is this idea of why are we creating? Like if it's a hobby, sure, let's leave it as a hobby. But if our goal is to be a professional, if our goal is to impact other people and other people are telling us it sucks, then we need to change. We need to get better. We need to improve until people like you go, oh, we got to have Brendan on. He makes good videos, right? And it's getting to that place where we kind of just say the quality of work is so important that I don't care what feedback I get, but obviously it is difficult to swallow for a lot of people. So I would say choose the your mentors carefully and hopefully maybe softer ones, and then you could work your way up to people like me.
Exactly. Now, I think you obviously know more than anyone that public speaking, it scares the hell out of people. I mean, I myself, I'm on the fence. So I've given many talks, I've given lectures, from everyone to, kindergartners to all the way up to, adults. And even when I have to do it another one, I still get nervous. I mean, I've heard many people, many successful speakers say that nerves are good, because they show you that you care about the content and what you're doing. And I was wondering if you can expand on that. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, let me add an extra layer of thought to that. So definitely fear is a good thing in many ways, but let's dive in an interesting question nobody really talks about in my industry, which is why are we scared in the first place? Like where does the fear come from? Like I've been on shows, around, places, and they all go, oh, they all grow up in different places, but we all share that same fear. So where does it come from? So let me add more layer to that for the audience. The question we need to ask ourselves is a simple one. Where do we give most of our presentations? And the answer for most of us is also school, high school, elementary school, college, university. That's where we give most of them. Because we don't wake up one morning and go, hey, Chris, you want to get breakfast and present all day? Like, not really something that we do. So what happens is we're in high school together and three things occur. Number one, we never get to pick the topic. And if we do, it's generally something we're not passionate about. Think about, since you mentioned history, think about history classes and presenting the Renaissance. You're sitting there thinking, oh, is this like a fruit or something? But then you realize that it's a time period in history. I actually always use that analogy, but it's kind of cool that you're actually from history. So it's cool. It was a side note. It was like a cool side note. It's like, ooh, winner. Anyways, number
There you
two,
go.
the students that we're listening to, or rather that we're speaking in front of, don't care. Not because they don't care about us. We're all great people here. You're awesome. I'm awesome. The people that are listening to us are awesome. The issue is that school is one of the few presentation environments where you're presenting to people who are also presenting back to you. So let's say I'm speaking and I think I'm a bad speaker because I'm looking at everyone and I'm saying, oh crap, no one's paying attention to me. It's probably because I'm bad. Not true. The real reason, what's happening is you're sitting in the room biting your nails because you got to go 10 minutes after me. And you're like, okay, the sun is, oh no, was it orange or black? And you're like listening to yourself. You're not paying attention to me. Not because you don't want to, but because you're worried about your own thing, which isn't true for most presentations. Because now, in this conversation we're having, almost everyone's attention is on us. People are commuting, people are cooking, but they're paying attention to what we're saying. In school, that doesn't happen. Number three, teachers. Teachers are very well educated. Teachers are very well intentioned, but also very stressed. You got 70 students in a classroom, 50 students in a classroom, two classes to go through all of their presentations. Do you really have time to coach everyone individually for 10 minutes on their presentations?
Yeah, good
The
point.
answer is no. So let's recap. You never get to pick the topic in 100% of the presentations you give, pretty much. You're always presenting to students who don't care, and you're always being heard by teachers who don't have time to coach you. And this behavior gets repeated in every single subject: math, sciences, English, music, gym, French, on and on and on. we're taught to believe that public speaking is a chore. If you're at school, it's tied to a grade. If you're at work, it's tied to a result.
Yeah.
If you fail at any part of that journey, you get punished for it. So what's the punchline, Chris? The punchline is we need to understand the fear of public speaking has nothing to do with us, but rather the system in which we grew up learning it in the first place.
Yeah, that's a powerful point. I hope people go back and actually re-listen to that, because that's really, really important. And, you know, it's funny talking about school. I probably my most rewarding experience I had when I was a sophomore in high school, we had this English class and we actually started incorporating debate into it toward the end of the year. And they would give us a topic that we actually did, you know, we're passionate about. So they would say, okay, what are you guys passionate about? What do you guys want to debate about? And let's say sometimes the topic would be really, really, you know, controversial. Like let's say abortion would be the topic. And you, let's say you're not for abortion under any circumstance. So he would argue your part. And then after, you know, you argued your part and your opponent argued their part, then the teacher would tell us to flip roles. Okay, now tomorrow you're going to argue the opposite role. You're going to argue the opposite part, and you're going to try to get on the other side of that coin and see why that other person feels so strongly against what you feel. And that really gave us a lot of good perspective. And I think it made us sort of a little uncomfortable, but I think in a good way. And I that's an experience I think I'll always remember, is because it made you have empathy toward your opponent, essentially, or the other side, or whatever you want to call it. I think that really builds a lot of character when it comes to presenting something.
I agree. And just this idea of building perspective that I can add here to the convo is this idea of most people don't do that enough. And that's why I think they make not just bad conversationalists and thinkers, but also bad speakers. Because if you're a hardcore Democrat, do you really think that a Republican doesn't have passions, doesn't have a family, doesn't have things that he cares about? Vice versa, if you're a Republican, hardcore, do you really think that a Democrat doesn't have the same passion, the same families, the same interests as you do? Same thing with anything. I just use that as an example. But if you care about something that somebody else doesn't, it's always important to learn from those perspectives. And I think what makes great speakers amazing is not that they're special or more important or more unique. They just talk to more people in their audience. I have had hundreds of conversations with 8-year-olds, 57-year-olds, you know, teachers, you know, and all of these, the spectrum of people that I understand my audience and my customer more than anyone else in my industry.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I mean, and you know, I wanted to actually ask you about something that's people, I guess, say is kind of a myth maybe in public speaking, and maybe you can sort of, you know, myth bust a little bit for us. But I've heard speakers that talk about, you know, just giving presentations and kind of, you know, doing that, and that above anything else, during a presentation, they'll try to convey specific things in an event that they feel like this moment, their talk, it's maybe not connecting in the way that they thought. So what I wanted to ask you is, are there fallbacks? Are there bare minimums that you want to make sure you hit with your audience every time if it's not going the way you anticipated it to go?
Not necessarily. I think the way that I think about it, if it doesn't go necessarily as you want it to give some tough love, you're doing something wrong. And what generally that thing is that you haven't presented the same presentation enough times. Because the issue with most speakers, which isn't true with professionals, is they present most presentations only once. So you have a presentation at work, presentation at school that you have to deliver. You're mostly spending probably 80% of your time on the content, the other 20% of your time putting the slides together. You don't really have time to think about engaging your audience. So that's why when you fall off and your execution's off, which is normal, you don't do as well. It's really hard to rebound. But if I threw it differently, if you did the same presentation 25 times, you never make mistakes because your content, you just know inside out. So what happens instead is you start thinking about how am I being conveyed here? What emotions am I communicating to this audience? Am I actually communicating the way they understand me? And a lesson I would give you, I guess, that would help is for you, that presentation is your own podcast, Chris, because you can make a presentation just on that show, what the dream is, what the aspirations are, what you're trying to achieve with it. And then from that, what happens is over time, the way that you explain your own podcast transitions from context giving, which is, hey guys, my name's Chris, this is the podcast, this is what I'm trying to do, to something like this. You know, when I used to have old conversations at the bar with my friends, I always stopped to think of myself. I wonder if other people could tune into these conversations to what they can learn. That's why I'm ex and then you just present in that way, right? And that
Yeah.
you eventually transition to that, where you're kind of thinking about every word and how every word is pronounced. But the way that I'm pushing here is, if there's fallback, if you need a backup plan, it's because your main plan wasn't practiced enough. It wasn't foolproof. So that's the way I would think about it.
I guess sort of touching on an earlier question, you know, with the explosion of Zoom and you know, which is what we're recording this on right now, other video conferencing platforms, you know, people obviously are now relying on giving their lectures and talks via video chat. You touched on this a little bit earlier. You know, Zoom's especially strong, you know, at least with they've got a whole bunch of tools you can use to help present. They got the whiteboard and all that stuff you can do. But what I wanted to ask you is, and I know you touched on it earlier, but what do we lose as a presenter, as an audience? I know you talked about the communication and under kind of getting, you know, the presenter getting the audience and vice versa, but when it's all digital, what do you have to do maybe in the preparation stage of the presentation to make up for that?
Yeah, I would say the general things that come to mind that aren't too complicated for people to implement right away is this idea of 10xing your energy. Because the challenge that we have, besides the whole audience reaction thing that we talked about earlier, is, well, you can't really talk to your audience. You can't really talk to them, hug them, be near them, understand them, feel their energy. And I think that's very important. Like, for example, to be transparent here, and I used to wake up for 7 a.m. workshops. I obviously didn't want to get out of bed. I was just like, oh God. But the second I got there and I saw 15-year-old girls watched my videos and goes, oh my God, Brendan, like, you're the master talk guy. I'm excited to see you, right? That kind of stuff. And all it takes is one person to do that to me, and I just go crazy. I'm like, yes, this is gonna be a great workshop. I love it. I haven't slept for 3 days, but it doesn't matter. Let's make this happen, right? Because she's counting on me, and I don't get that online, right? I don't get that, right? I see Julia in the screen, but it's not the same as like talking to her. And this is true with 56-year-old grand, uncle or something. It doesn't matter, right? But the point is, so the key is you need to compensate for that energy. So right now I'm actually putting in a lot more effort than I usually do, because we're just not in person. So I have to add more energy as I would have if I was there in person talking to you. So that's one easy thing people could do. The other thing that I know isn't, it's not super complicated advice. It's not the hardest thing in the world, but it's difficult to get right, is just to do the same presentation over and over again. Like, as of today, my keynote that I've given now, I've probably given that singular presentation 400 times now. Not 40 times, 400. So when I get into a class and I start presenting, when the hour's over, they kind of just go, whoa, like the time just flew. Because you're just obsessive about every minute of every second of everything that you're saying. That comes with practice, absolutely.
Yeah, and is there a certain amount of confidence that you gain? Well, obviously, the more you do it, I mean, it's kind of a silly question, but I think it bears repeating.
Yeah, absolutely. But one thing I'll add there as a layer is this idea of how do you build confidence, right? And I think there's two parts to that. One part, as you alluded to very well, is preparation. Of course, if you're practicing 500 times, you're just going to be 500 times better, generally speaking. The other side of the equation that not many people talk about is this idea of having a belief system. Most people, most coaches, I would say, when they recommend, oh, like, how do I get over nerves, Chris? How do I like be more confident? They say, you should drink a glass of water. You should like breathe. You should like pretend to be confident, power pose or something. I think that's all BS. I think that's just not helpful. It's fixing a symptom, not the core issue. The core issue that's not being talked about is most people don't believe in anything. They don't believe in what they're trying to present. They don't believe in the ideas they're trying to share. Why? Because they're not super clear on the people that they're trying to help. And I'm the living and breathing example of this. Once again, I started Master Talk at the age of 22, and I started coaching CEOs at 23. That's insane. Who the
It
hell am
is.
I to coach these people? They're like 50 years old. What gave me the confidence? Well, obviously, some of the CEOs are younger, but you know what I mean? Like, what gave me the confidence to coach these people without a PhD or even a bachelor's degree in communication? So one part of that, definitely preparation. I just knew what I was talking about. That's given. You just need to know what you're saying. The second part of it, though, is I believed in a world where 15-year-old kids, 8-year-old kids, 17-year-old kids would have access to free communication tools, so that they could share their ideas with the world. And not just them, but everyone who couldn't afford me. But because I had a belief system in that world, I didn't care who I needed to help. As long as they wanted to be helped, I needed to be more wiser. I needed to get more sharper so that I could use the proceeds, the financial gains from their coaching fees, so that I can make better production and videos for everybody. So it's that belief in that way the world should be that fuels my confidence and the way I want it to be, not because I'm just presenting and I'm hoping for the best, but because these people, millions of people, I fundamentally believe millions of people are currently relying on me to share their ideas with the world. So I see it as a moral responsibility to be as great of a speaker as I can, because who in the world would listen to a speech coach who doesn't know how to speak, right? So I think the bottom line is answering the following question for yourself. And that question is, how would the world change if you were an incredible speaker? If you were one of the best speakers on the planet, how would the world change? And if you don't have a good answer to that question, it's going to be much harder for you to build confidence. Because if you answer something like, oh, I get a promotion at work, you're not going to go far, let me tell you right now. But if you say, hey, I have this podcast where I can share insights with people. And if I get better at communication, I could share more ideas. I'm always arguing with my partner all the time. If I get better at just understanding her or understanding him, we'd probably fight a lot less, because I don't think there's anything wrong in their perspective. We're just miscommunicating a lot. That's the type of world I'm talking about. We're not talking about changing millions of people. We're talking about impacting the people that we want to impact. And if we're more specific about that world, we won't fear public speaking anymore. We'll be a lot more confident about what we're trying to do.
Last week I watched a video, one of your videos actually, and it was just how to speak on camera. We'll definitely put a link to it on the show notes tonight. But you opened it with mentioning that there are no jump cuts or edits in your videos. It's start, speak, and stop. And that might not seem like a huge deal for people who are listening to this, but at first, when you think about the content we all consume from YouTubers and influencers and presenters and et cetera, there are jump cuts and edits everywhere. And it made me think to ask you, does the safety and the reliability of post-production and the editing bay and all that good stuff, does it make it easier or less compromising even for the content creator as opposed to like start, speak, stop? I mean, is there a major benefit to mastering that aspect of your presentations, of your video, of your content?
That's a fascinating question. So one thing I will add as a transparency point here is my new videos are jump cut, but not as definitely not nearly as much as most people. So I probably do five jumps, so one for the intro, one for part one, part two, part three, close, and that's it. I don't jump in the middle though, so which is still, good. I mean, it's not bad or anything.
No,
It's
agreed.
definitely less than most. But when I started YouTubing, you're right, I did used to do 8 10 minutes straight, mostly because I didn't want to edit my videos and I wasn't good at it and it wasn't something I wanted to spend time on. That's why when I used to do videos, when I was 5 minutes into a video and I screwed up, and I actually start back at the beginning and go, did you know I'm Brendan? I would start again. So yeah, it was definitely painful, but I think what the lesson it taught me is it made me demonstrably good on camera in a very short period of time. Because people need to realize that I started YouTubing probably January 2019, and I got really good on camera in probably 8 months. That's not because I'm special, though. That's not because I'm cool or important, because that's definitely not it. I just practiced a shit ton of times more than most people. Like I would think I was presenting. I think I presented on camera that year 500 times. So that was a mix of, the mistakes I was making in my basement because I kept restarting. But another thing I was doing that people can do tomorrow is I would post on IG stories every day on Instagram. So let's say I would open my Instagram and just click on stories and just say a thought for 20 seconds. Hey guys, my name's Brendan and this is what I'm thinking today. This is a quote that I like. See you tomorrow. That takes like 30 seconds. But what it does is it builds your muscle up every day. So I did that, what, 300 times in the last year, and I did the camera presentations a couple of hundred times. So then I went from essentially, so hi everyone, my name's Brendan too. Did you know that? And then you kind of get into that. So yeah, just practice. Progression leads to obsession.
Good point. And it's funny, before I get to the next question, I'll tell you a little story. We interviewed a gentleman by the name of Mark Hall Patton. He's actually a guest star on Pawn Stars. He's been like on every episode of the show, and he's from with the Clark County Museum in Nevada, Clark County, Nevada, and he runs like three different museums. And he was telling us a story when we were interviewing, sort of off the record, about how he goes and does lectures, and but he doesn't he something about this guy, he doesn't prepare for his lectures. He does like questions where people will just get into an audience and just shoot him questions about any point in history. I mean, it does not matter. You can't nail this guy. It's just, he can just sit there and talk about any point in history very intelligently. You know, it's not something he just, it's not fluff answers. It's not filler. It's a legitimate detailed answer. And so, you know, shifting gears a bit to that, I don't script my interviews. I'll jot down, you know, some keywords and phrases so I can remember sort of, you know, what to ask you about, what to ask my guest about. And obviously you didn't know what I was going to ask beforehand. So this is one of those types of interviews, or one of those types, it's not live, but one of those types of deals when you're just fielding questions from me, you don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. And is preparation for that type of an interview or discussion or presentation, is that different? Or are there any tips that you have for situations like that?
Absolutely. So the way that I think about this is what I call question drills. So most people that come up to me and say they're scared about answering questions, what I do is I always make them do the harder exercise. So I get a group of really tough people, like some of the smartest people in my network, which usually means not the nicest. Those are usually the smart people, in my opinion, anyways. And they, not nice as in like they're kind people, but critical with feedback. That's
right,
what I mean.
Right.
So what we do is we spend 2 hours just roasting that person on a Zoom call, normally in person. And we ask them hundreds of questions. I go to slide 70. Why did you say this? Go to like, our only objective is to poke 100 holes. So after 2 hours, that person is exhausted. But what happens is when they get into an interview like you and you're just saying, oh, so Brendan, just tell me about this. You know, it's not like you're trying to attack me, right? It's just a question. I go, wait, I'm not being attacked? Well, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Right? This is life. So it's all about it's everything in public speaking, I find, or really anything in life, is all about how you perceive it, right? If you perceive something to be hard, it'll probably be hard. But if you do something much harder, similar to running a 60-mile race for practicing 60 miles for a 40-mile marathon, well, then the 40-mile marathon becomes a joke because you've been practicing 60, right? So I think the key, And I think one of the reasons why I've done so well, I guess, you know, in answering questions, I guess, in general with podcasts, is just because I've done 200 shows. It's not because I'm more special. Because what happens after, for the punchline, for those who are waiting for it, is at some point, especially if you're a subject matter expert in what you're doing, at some point, like, what question have you not been asked? Like, yeah. If people come up to you and go, well, Brendan, you know, what, how do you think we should be adapting to COVID and virtual? Well, I've gotten that question more than once, right?
Right.
So,
right.
So I think the key is more about acknowledging that as long as you have an idea worth sharing and you share it enough times, trust me, it'll come easier. It'll be a lot more easier for you to communicate that message. Though I will say, as a bonus, because this is something you might be surprised by, even if I'm pretty casual in my podcast interviews, because it's more of a conversation, mm-hmm. In my actual YouTube videos, I actually script everything word for word. Mm. I do not use a teleprompter, though. But the reason why I script everything on YouTube is because I hate watching unstructured videos. Because the challenge of the YouTube space, since I don't do interviews, it's just me talking, I want to make sure that I'm getting to the point. So what I do is I write out everything in full. So I write a YouTube script every day. And then when I present it, I present it authentically and fresh as if I never wrote it. But yeah. I read it over just to make sure I have the right structure, and then I communicate it.
And these parts I did jot down because this is important. I just watched it was another TED Talk a few weeks ago, and it was by Celeste Headlee, who I'm going to hopefully have on the show pretty soon. And the title of the talk is 10 Ways to Have Better Conversation. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes, too. And she made some excellent points, and I thought it'd be fun to sort of run them through you and get your take on her points. Yeah. And maybe allow you to sort of adapt those points for live presentation and for lectures. So the first point she made, the first of the 10, is don't multitask, you know, stay on point. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay. I'll play a different card here. And I think the card I'm going to play is, I don't think that's the right approach in how to think about conversations.
Okay.
I think the biggest mistake that people make is they're talking to the wrong people. So let's say, for example, I'm super passionate about something. I love working on impact-driven projects, but I'm talking to somebody who's really selfish. It doesn't matter how I pigeonhole or what tricks I use or if I multitask or not. I just won't get along with this person.
Hmm.
Versus with you, I could make 50 mistakes in this podcast. You could say or all half the time. I'll still like you. Why? Yeah. Because you're trying to build something meaningful. You're actually trying to contribute something. And that means a lot to me. So we're just going to vibe just because of that. So I think what's missing in that framework, though I will review the videos after this podcast, and it interests me because I've seen it in the recommend. I just never watched it.
Yeah, check it out. It's good.
Yeah. So the way that I think about conversations with people is you need to put yourself in a situation where the people you're going to meet, that they're going to like you regardless. So here's an example that's personal to me. So my favorite show of all time, right, is this podcast called The School of Greatness by Lewis Howes. He's a personal hero of mine, and I've learned a lot from him and his podcast. He's very early to the game. You know, he started the show when Jordan Harbinger and all those guys started podcasting. So that's why he has a lot of success. But what most people don't know is that Lewis has a live event every year called Summit of Greatness that is in the middle of nowhere. So in this place called Columbus, Ohio, in the States. But the thing is because it's in the middle of nowhere, when you go to that event, it's like this weird utopian society where everyone listens to the show and everyone does personal development. So when I went there the first time in September of 2019, yet I didn't think much of it. I was just gonna see who was there. And I just started talking to a bunch of these people. And every single time I approached one of them and I just said, "What are you passionate about?" They all looked at me, paused for 2 seconds, put their hand on my shoulder and said, "Well, Brendan, what are you passionate about though? And how can I help you?" And I just went, "Whoa, this is freaky." But these people were my people. It didn't really matter if I was pigeonholing my best friend. We talk about 10 different topics at the same time. It doesn't really matter. It's just the fact that like these people get me and I get them. So here's my challenge for people when COVID's over. If you are the only person that likes pen collecting and nobody else understands you, they're like, "What are you doing, Chris? What are you collecting these pens for?" My challenge, spend a couple of $100, fly out to the biggest pen collecting conference in the world or a small one, and I promise you will meet more friendships in the 3-day event than you would have in the last year.
Yeah. All right. On to the second one. Pontification. She says, you know, don't pontificate. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I definitely agree. But once again, I think the criticism I would give is I would, even for me as a professional, I don't even know what pontification means. So if you're trying, like, you know, that's my pet peeve, I guess, with academia, though no offense to her. I'm sure she's amazing and does amazing work. It's just this idea of, you know, a lot of people use a lot of fancy terms like glossophobia. For those who don't know, that's a medical term for the fear of public speaking. And I'm just there like, what's the point of talking about this lingo? It's not helping people get better as speakers. So that's just my criticism there. But I agree. I think, like, for example, in this conversation, I've probably gloated a bit too much, but I always balanced it off by saying how stupid I was in certain aspects. I don't think I screwed up too badly.
No,
but
not at all.
But I think the thing I want to push with pontification is I agree, but at the same time, what I'll say is there's a way that you can do it in a way that builds rapport. So let's say, for example, I'm having a conversation with you, Chris, and I ask you what you're passionate about, and you say, "Oh, I'm a podcaster, and I love creating content." So what I could say is I could reply by saying, "Oh, Chris, that's awesome. I'm also a content creator. I make YouTube videos on such and such," just to build a rapport. But then at the end, I won't just talk about myself. I'll say, "So tell me, what's your experience been like as a content creator? I'd love to learn from you more on that subject." So what I'm doing here is I'm signaling to you that I'm one of you, but I'm also more curious about you than I am about talking about myself. So I think what we can call this, I'm kind of just thinking on the fly, we can call this semi-pontification, where you talk about yourself in a way that gets the other person interested in you while keeping the conversation focused on them.
How about using, she talks about using open-ended questions to get, you know, in her case, just use open-ended questions during a conversation, but in your case, maybe to get an audience engaged or just in a one-on-one conversation.
That part I completely agree with. We're definitely on the same page on open-ended questions. I hate close-ended questions. They don't. Do you like fruits, Chris? Yes or no? Like, it just doesn't,
right.
doesn't get us anywhere. Rather than saying, "Hey, Chris, what inspired you to start the podcast? Talk to us. Talk to me about the vision." That's how we have deeper conversation. I completely agree with her. Open it,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, agreed. How about going with the flow of going with the flow of the conversation, making it organic, or in this case, the presentation, you know, what you prepared. I mean, not veering too far off of what you prepared, maybe just kind of stick to that. What do you think of that?
I agree. I think what generally happens, kind of to make this more tangible for people, at the beginning, you're not going with the flow, right? You're nervous. You never gave this presentation before. You're stressing. You might be, you know, doing a couple of things that you won't want to be doing. But the key is, after you do it a couple of times and you gain confidence, that's when you start going with the flow. So when I first started presenting my keynote, like, I was horrendous. You know, I'd give a speech and just go, "I don't know." But after 50 times, you start to gain a confidence that you wouldn't otherwise. And then if you start making mistakes, you don't worry too much about it. So I think go with the flow is something that you earn over time. That's unless you're natural at it, but I don't think most people are.
And the next one is one I really wanted to ask you about, and because we've all heard this, you know, whether we're getting chastised or something like that by a, you know, in school or by a boss or something like that. If you don't know, say that you don't know. So like in a conversation, if someone says, you know, gives you a question you don't know the answer to, like just be honest and say, I don't know that answer to that question, but I can figure it out for you, or whatever the case is. Like, what are your thoughts on just expressing, hey, I don't know. I mean, you did that earlier with, you know, with pontification. It's like, what is it? And then now we can kind of talk about it. What are your thoughts on that aspect of it?
Right. So I think the way that I see it is I think it's a half half. So for example, saying I don't know is totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But if there's some value that you can add even a little bit, I would add it. So let's say, for example, you asked me a question, I would say, well, I'm not sure, but here's my thinking. This is what I'm currently thinking about as you're asking me. So that way I'm adding as much value as I can. Because I don't like people who always just say I don't know all the time. Versus people who go, I'm not 100% sure, but let's just brainstorm ideas. Like I just made up that half pontification thing because if you're asking, it means your audience wants to have an answer to that. So I don't want to just leave it and just go, I don't know, next question, right? So I think
You're
there's a
right.
mix between the two.
What about, and this is you know, this is obviously what she's talking about is one-on-one conversation maybe. So I can kind of understand that, but it, you know, you'll probably have a different take on this, but one of the points she makes is don't equate your experience with theirs or that of your audience. You know, like if you're talking with someone, like let them sort of kind of drive essentially, and don't equate your experience with theirs. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Can you give an example of that? Would that be like, oh, you have a PhD, so I have to say I have a PhD too, or something?
I think that's, you know, try to make it so that, you know, you have experience that matches their experience, you know, and I don't know that I agree with that one potentially, but, you know, I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
So I think one way of thinking about this in a way that makes sense for the audience is it's all about the people you want to talk to. So for instance, if your goal is to be an academic and talk to other academics and to build research and to do that kind of stuff, it totally makes sense to match experiences because you want to show in that tiny world of academics that you want that you're a part of it too. So that way they take you more seriously. But if your goal is to make an impact in the world, and I'm not saying you're not going to make impact around academics, but like if you want to like impact, I don't know, millions of people and you're just curious as an individual and you're pretty open as a person, you probably won't match experiences because those people in those circles won't really see that as a plus. They won't really see it as a minus either, but it's not adding value. So let's say if I met you for the first time, I wouldn't tell you how great I am for 10 minutes about how master talking with the accomplishments. I'll just tell you that I make YouTube videos and ask you about your life, right? But I think the key is like it all depends on the person you're trying to speak to. If your goal is to get into some fancy, exclusive club that only few people get into, it makes sense to match experiences and just show that you're qualified to be there. But if, on the other hand, your goal is just to meet interesting people, like I'm sure it is for you and me, then I don't really care particularly about doing that. I think it's more about taking an interest in the other person and seeing how you can add value to that person's ambition and what they're trying to achieve.
Okay. And her next one is try not to repeat yourself.
I don't care about that. I don't agree with that. I just, if you repeat yourself, like I think you know why I'm pretty aggressive on this one is because I think it's sending the wrong message. As if I repeat something, people are not going to hate. They're going to start walking away in conversation. So what's it causes unnecessary stress that's just unneeded. I've probably repeated the same thing 7 times in this very show, right? So and you don't hate me less for it, right? You don't
Right,
really.
right.
And so I think I'll say the reverse. So by reverse, I mean if you end up repeating things on ax by accident and people take less of an interest to you because of it, that is more to say about them than it is about you. Whereas me, when I converse with people, and this is just a personal value of mine, if I see somebody is struggling, I don't laugh at them and say that you're a bad communicator. Let me walk away from this conversation. That's so rude. Instead, I
Right.
just say, hey, like that Pola example I gave before. Hey, are you struggling right now? Let me just lower my vocal tones. Let me make this space more safer for you to speak to me. And then you're going to open yourself up to me. So I think it's about seeking those people rather than the people who say, oh, did you just repeat the same thing, Chris? I'm just going to walk away from this interview right now. Like,
Right,
that's kind of
right.
crazy. I don't think it sends the right message.
What about listening and the role that plays in the conversation? I mean, obviously that seems like a no-brainer, but I mean, can you talk about just the importance of listening to you know, whether it's a one-on-one conversation, you talked about like maybe a husband or wife, you know, kind of understanding or listening to your audience or your feedback. I know we've talked a lot about that today, but just kind of give us like a real brief summary of like kind of what what listening does, even on a live show like that or a live presentation.
Absolutely. And I would say definitely guilty as charged. Listening is something I struggled with for many years, because as you probably tell, I talk a lot. That's why I'm a YouTuber and a podcast guest. But I think what made the difference for me and the advice I have for people, because I don't want to preach the importance of listening. We all know it's important, but rather how to practice it more effectively. So my advice is put yourself in conversations that you can't respond to, even if you wanted to. Listening to a conversation like this is actually the best way to master listening. The reason is because, let's say Julia is watching us and listening to us speak. She can't interrupt us because this conversation is already over. It's happened in the past. So what I used to do, and I still do today, is I used to listen to an hour or two of podcasting every day. And what this does is I also take notes during the conversation, which means I'm not allowed to say a word. I can't. The conversation is done. I can't interact with these people. The issue that people have with practicing listening in person, especially in a trio, let's say it's me, you, and Julia. I'm just using Julia as an example here.
Yeah.
And you and Julia are talking. I'm not actually listening to you. I'm thinking about what to say so that I'm valuable in the conversation. So I'm kind of practicing listening 50%. Whereas if you're always podcasting and listening to other people's stories, whether you're as a host or in my case as a listener, over time you get really good at listening. So now I'm in a place where I can listen to someone for 15 minutes and never tell them anything about my life.
Her last point is again, it's just kind of driving home, kind of being brief. You know, just when you're talking about something, nail a point and leave it at that and don't go too far into the weeds. I mean, what do you think about that?
Once again, depends on the person. I don't agree with that as a generalization. Like for me, as you probably noticed, I'm not brief at all with my answers. I don't just go, I agree, I disagree. No, I was like, no, let's get into the gray. Let me like give you the whole full context.
Right.
And you know, and I'm sure that's something you appreciate and the audience appreciates, because like finally there's somebody who's actually nailing this down for us.
Right.
So I don't think that's a hard rule. And I actually think that's the challenge. And that's why I'm not hitting too much on Celeste's work. And the reason is because we're in a tough space. And the tough space is, how do you explain something that's very gray in a way that's black and white for people? So I'm trying to say here, once explaining how do you take something that's very vague as a concept like social skills in a way that's rules-based? Because what Celeste is trying to do, which I completely acknowledge and respect, which is what I'm trying to do as well, is how do we explain these rules as a rule so that people actually do something with it? Because that's how clueless people are, in the same way I'm clueless about cooking or other things.
Right.
So in that way, I definitely admire her work and what she's doing. But in that context, for that tip, I think what I would say instead to get people to take action is, if you're talking to the right person and you're having the right conversation, it won't matter anymore if you're brief or not, because people just want to hear you talk. They're interested in hearing what you have to say. Obviously, there's some moments where you're just monologuing for 15 minutes and it's just too much. I mean, let's talk about that too. But the point that I'm driving here is, you know, if you take 2 extra minutes to explain your thoughts, I'm not going to walk away from the conversation. I want to hear your thought process.
Well, I can't tell you how much monologuing I've cut out of my shows. It's been pretty bad, you know, when I'm doing my all of our podcasts and our stuff we're doing on history and things. It's just, that's total monologue. Let's cut that out. It doesn't make sense. All right. I wanted to ask you about learning good communication and presentation skills as kids. I mean, you touched on it a little bit earlier, but I remember when my son was in kindergarten, he'd have to go up in front of the class and do like his star of the week presentation. And of course he's a little guy, so he was real scared and nervous, and, you know, they talk real soft and they get to that point. But when we're in grade school, presentations come into our lives, they can be nerve wracking, especially at a young age. What are your thoughts about working this mental muscle out when you're young? I mean, how important is that foundationally?
So important. Actually, my best client that I ever worked with is 7 years old. And she's incredible. She's actually one of the best speakers I've ever met in my life. Wow. And I think the reason why kids get this so well is because they're open to new ideas and new thoughts. But the issue is, because of the education system that we talked about earlier, it forces them into this rabbit hole of, no, Sarah, you're going to present what I tell you to, as if we're their boss. Whereas I have my own kids program, what I do with, they're my executives as kids, essentially. And this is something I would love for other educators to steal. Like what I'm saying right now, please implement it with your kids. Like it's not copyright. I'm not going to sue you or anything. do it. So basically what I do with them is, in the first conversation I have with in her case, she was 6 when she started the program. She's 7 now. And I just asked her, I treated her like a grown-up. I just said, let's call her Julia. I said, Julia, what do you like? Like, what excites you about life? And she replied with, oh, well, I love school. Like, my first day of school was amazing. And I go, why don't you make a presentation about that? In 4 weeks, she went from like, this is my first day of school to like, there's a dragon in my class. We start singing in our intro. It was gold, like so amazing. I'll send you that after because I have it recorded. It's really amazing to see. It really reminds me why I do the work that I do. But I think the idea is she doesn't have to be the exception to the rule. All we need to do as educators is do the following thing. Treat them as if they're the same age as us. If we're 40, we treat them like a 40-year-old. We make them present. We make them own the topic that they want to present. And we give them feedback on the same presentation over and over again. Because what's stressful for your son and every other kid out there is this is the first time they're presenting that. So what we do with the kids in my program is they present the first time they're nervous, but the next week's presentation is the same one. It's not we're switching topics. They don't have to rack their brains around finding new content. Instead, I look at her and I go, when you say dragon, can you say it a bit slower? And they go, yes. And then after 4 weeks, every word is thought of, every word is perfect, and they become perfect speakers. And then their confidence just breaks through the roof, and then they're on a whole other level.
Yeah, and and on that note, I mean, my son is obviously he's grown up in the internet age. He's grown up in the gaming and the Fortnite and the Minecraft age. There's
Right.
so many kids that, it's that's all they do. It's what they do. Is it possible that technology and sort of the age that we've grown up in has created, more introverted people than ever before? Are we facing almost, I dare I say, like an epidemic of people that just don't have that foundational, communicative skill?
I'm not going to give a hard answer to this one. I'll give another balanced one, like the one with social media, in the sense that pros and cons. The biggest pro of tech is it allows you to find the people that you're meant to find. So it's a lot easier to find your tribe. So let's say I'm a video game aficionado. I love this specific game. I can meet other people within that genre a lot easier, and I can connect with them, have more conversations with them, play along with them with the headset, and I'm communicating with them just fine. But the opposite is also true. If I use that as an excuse never to go out and meet them in person, never to go to more events, to go to more parties, to go to more places where I can practice social skills, I also become more introverted than I naturally would have been otherwise. So I think the message to this whole dialogue is understanding how to use technology in the right way. If we use technology to hide ourselves from society, which some people definitely do, then of course, our kids are going to grow up to be anxious adults that don't know how to have proper conversations with people. But instead, if we use that same technology to connect them with other people who are like-minded, oh, do you like comic books? Well, this person likes comic books, and allows them to develop relationships with people around the world who share the same interests as them, who are the same age as them, then that experience becomes a lot more fun, a lot more interesting, and a lot better of seeing the optimistic side of technology rather than the pessimistic one, which I always choose to do.
Now, as we wrap up tonight, you've given us a lot of tips today. You've given a ton of tips, obviously, on your YouTube channel, which of course we'll link to in the show notes tonight. But give us your, as we kind of wrap up, give us your three biggest tips for public speaking. If you can only get across three things, what would they be?
All right, so my three tips. Okay, so let's go number one, book recommendation. If anyone wants to get better at public speaking, check out Thirst by Scott Harrison. It's an amazing tale about how somebody who went from a nightclub promoter used storytelling, branding, and marketing to change the world. I think he's an amazing communicator, and it's the number one book I recommend public speaking. Number two, I would remember this idea of the repeatable presentation. If you present the same thing 400 times, that is the easiest way and the fastest way to be an incredible speaker. And the third thing, I'll give a life advice, which I think embodies everything we talked about. It's my favorite quote. And the quote is, be insane or be the same. If you're still listening to this episode and you still care about what I have to say for some reason, the only advice I have left for you is the understanding that the only way to do something great is to do extreme things. Extreme people get extreme results. Don't you find it odd that a 22-year-old kid started a YouTube channel on public speaking, went to coach CEOs at the age of 23, but also lives in his mother's basement, is talking to Chris right now on a mattress, doesn't own a car, doesn't plan on moving out of his mother's house till he's 30, and karaoke's in eight different languages. And that is the point. When all of the decisions that you make only make sense to the only person that matters, which is you, you're probably making the right decisions.
Wow, that is a one hell of a way to end tonight. Okay, so before we head out, The very last thing I want to do, and this has sort of become a tradition here on the show, is this questionnaire that was invented by French television host Bernard Pivot and made famous here in the States by the legendary interviewer James Lipton. Now, there are 10 questions. Are we ready to go here?
Drill me quick on him. Let's go.
All right. Well, first question. What is your favorite word?
Favorite word, insanity.
What is your least favorite word?
Impossible. Yeah, probably.
Yeah. What turns you on?
People who are working on really incredible shit.
What turns you off?
People who are lazy and don't do shit with their lives and complain all the time.
What sound or noise do you love?
There's this Korean song called Act On Musician by two siblings called Melted. That's the best sound that I've ever heard in my life.
That will go into the show notes tonight. What sound or noise do you hate?
People screeching and complaining about stuff that's stupid. So like people getting frustrated about a $4 latte in a Starbucks. I hate that kind of noise. It makes my ears bleed.
All right. Number seven is probably the everybody's favorite question. What is your favorite curse word?
Curse word, probably shit, if that counts. If not, fuck.
Yeah, shit is a good one. It's like that's the all-American one. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I probably won't do that, but if I did have to do, I always wanted to be a stand-up comedian growing up. I just decided not to because of the lifestyle. So that's probably what I would have done.
Interesting. I think you'd be good. What profession would you not like to attempt?
Plumber. It's not for me.
Agreed. No disrespect to the plumbers out there.
That's no, not at all. We need you. Yeah. I swear to God, I need you.
That's a hard-ass job.
I can't do it, though, but please keep doing yours.
Yes, agreed. Now, the last question that we'll end tonight, and probably the most profound. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
You didn't play under your potential.
That's a good one.
The exact person that you were supposed to become, you exactly did it. You became that person.
Before we get out of here tonight, please plug the website, plug your YouTube channel, your podcast, plug it all, and we'll obviously have it all in the show notes as well.
Of course. So for people who want to check out the YouTube videos, it's Master Talk in one word. And if you want to check out Instagram, it's Master Your Talk.
You know, this has been one of the most powerful conversations I think I've ever had. And I really appreciate you joining me and giving the insight that you have. And, you know, like, what can I say? You are a class act, and I appreciate you. And thank you so much for your time tonight.
Of course, it's my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, search the handle @meandmyfriendspod. If you've enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes and rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Tonight, the podcast featured the original track, Mixtape, by producer Redeman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc. and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2020. All rights reserved.